Welcome to episode 5 of the Crooked Row podcast. This week I'll be giving you an update on my knitting and the dirt under my nails, as well as a contest winner, our very first contest winner, and a brief discussion on knowing your roots. So stay tuned. It is August. It is mid-August. It is getting rapidly closer and closer to fall. And I have finished a cardigan, so I will have something to keep me warm. I've been working on the Sarissaver cardigan by Bonne Marie Burns of Chic Knits. And I had been making that out of a cotton and linen blend yarn. And I finished it 2 days ago. 1 day ago? 2 days ago. And washed it, and it is currently drying. And I will share a couple of thoughts with you on that cardigan. I should have gone down to needle size for the lace parts. Now, to describe what the cardigan looks like, from just below the bust line on down, it's in reverse stockinette, and then from just below the bust, up to the shoulders, and then down the lengths of the arms, it is done in a lace pattern. And the gauge is stated in stockinette stitch, which I got, and my finished product has the required gauge. But it's pretty clear to me that I must be knitting looser when I'm knitting lace. I mean, I know there's all the yarn overs and everything, but my lace seems to be larger than what was intended in the pattern. And I know this because on the sleeves, when you're picking up stitches around the sleeves, it's done top down, and then you pick up stitches around the armhole and work down the length of the sleeve. And when it said to pick up the stitches, it gave about a ratio of, you know, pick up this many stitches for this many, you know, the typical pick up 3 stitches for every 4 stitches that you see when you're picking up along the side of a piece. And I did not have as many stitches as I was apparently supposed to. So I went ahead and picked up the amount of stitches that was required, and it looks fine. There's not a problem with the shoulder. But I noticed then that there might be something off with my gauge. But I didn't have anything to check it against because there was no gauge listed for the lace part, for lace stitch. But as I knit down the length of the sleeve, it's the pretty standard, you know, decrease a couple stitches every so many rows, do that this many times, etc., etc. And as I went down the length of the sleeve, I realized if I kept decreasing the number of times that the pattern indicated, these sleeves were going to be far too long. And then I thought, well, you know, my gauge swatch, when I washed it in the washing machine, it did want to shrink vertically. And I could stretch it back out and block it back out to be the original size. But maybe what I could do is go ahead and knit these sleeves too long, as it was, unwashed, wash it, and then maybe the sleeves would be the right length. And then I could stretch out the length of the cardigan, block that out. So essentially I was planning on solving my issues with washing and blocking selectively. It's still drying. I have not tried it on, but I have a feeling I am going to end up having to rip back a little bit on the sleeves and binding off an inch or two sooner, which will look fine. It's still going to be a great fitting cardigan either way. The only problem is the sleeves are going to be a little looser because I will not have decreased down to the number of stitches that you're supposed to by the time you get to the wrist. So the sleeves will be a little looser. So if I want to push the sleeve up, you know, if you're washing dishes or something and you want to push your sleeves up, it might be a little trickier to get my sleeves to stay up on my elbows. But other than that, I really like how it fits. I did lengthen the hem. I think I mentioned in the last episode that I was probably going to rip out the bind off along the bottom of the cardigan, since, like I mentioned, it's a top down. So the bind off was along the bottom hem of the sweater, and I did end up doing that. I ripped it out, ripped out the bottom ribbing, the bottom inch of ribbing, and continued in the reverse stockinette for another couple inches, and then added the inch of ribbing back on. And I'm glad I did that. I like it longer. I think it fits the style of the cardigan to be longer. It doesn't look quite right if it hits at hip length. It looks better if it hits you down below the hip. So we'll see how the sleeves turn out. But other than that, I really like it. I like the yarn. It seemed to soften really nicely with washing. The linen, you know, if you've ever knit with unwashed linen, it's pretty coarse feeling, kind of twiny feeling when you knit it. And that was lessened somewhat because it's a cotton linen blend. But even so, it felt just slightly scratchy when I would try it on. But after washing, it really softens it up a lot, and I know it will be a very durable yarn, and I like that. I think it will be a very nice sweater to wear as the weather starts cooling off, if it ever does start to cool off, over t-shirts and things this fall. So, looking forward to that. The other project that I have had on and off my needles since the last episode are my little fishy socks that I was knitting for my son. That is a Knit Picks pattern, which is part of their independent designer program. It's by Melissa Dominguez. It's called Small Fry. I had forgotten what the name was the last time when I mentioned it, but it is Small Fry. There have not been many projects of it knit, only a few projects. But it is a really cute pattern. They're little colorwork fish. The pattern originally has you using a multicolored hand-painted yarn for the fish, and then a solid color for the background. And I changed that and just did two solid colors. I have green fish on a blue background with a short row heel. And then I did stray from the pattern where she wrote the pattern to where you do a 1x1 rib all down the length of the foot, and the fish are just on the leg of the sock. And I did not want to knit 1x1 rib for, what was it, 3 inches or so. I mean, it's not very far. It's a kid's sock, but I couldn't do it. And my son had a very strong opinion that the fish should go clear down the top of the foot. I asked him what he thought about it, and he is a very opinionated four-year-old, and he would hear nothing of having a plain foot. The fish needed to go down the foot. So I did that. I just continued working in color work down the length of the foot and then across the sole of the foot. I just did what I would call like a checkerboard pattern. There's probably really a term for this, but I haven't done a lot of color work, so I'm not sure what it's called, but I would just alternate blue, green, blue, green, blue, green, blue, green, and then the next row I would go green, blue, green, blue, green, blue, green, blue, just one stitch at a time. So it makes it look different. It makes a very dense fabric on the bottom. And here's the things that I would change about what I did. If I were to do it again, I would knit the heel in a smaller needle. I knit the rest of the sock on size 2s, but I would have gone down to at least a 1, maybe even smaller for the heel. Because since the heel is not in color work, the gauge is looser because the color work tends to pull the stitches together and make more stitches per inch. The heel's a little bit looser, and even when he wears the sock, the heel looks, it looks looser, almost a little bit baggy. So if I were to do it again, that would be what I would change. If it becomes a problem fitting in his shoes, I might do a little sock surgery and see if I can cut the heel out and pick up the stitches and maybe do an afterthought heel and go down a couple needle sizes or so for the heel. I worry just a little bit about the durability of the heel because it's looser. The rest of the sock looks like it'll wear with iron, like iron. I'm maybe a little bit worried about the sock, but, you know, it's a kid's sock. I'll be lucky if I get one full winter out of it before he outgrows them. Anyway, so that's the fishy socks. And I have also started a second pair for my younger son. And they're going even faster because he has even smaller feet. And I'm knitting the smaller size in those. And I am just reversing the colors. So instead of the blue being the background and the green being the fish, I have the green being the background and the blue being the fish. And I am getting close to the toe on the first sock of that. So those should be done pretty quickly. They are going extremely fast. Knitting socks for little people is very gratifying. You get a finished product really quickly, and they're very cute. The next project that I will be casting on for shortly is the Lapis Yoke Pullover, which is in the Fall 2010 Knit Scene magazine by Hannah Fettig. I'm going to be knitting that out of a dark charcoal gray, which is kind of close to the color that it was knit in the magazine. In the magazine, that's a really dark indigo color, and I like the look of that, but I had a really dark charcoal gray, so it's going to have a similar look to it. And it's a pretty simple top-down pullover with some ribbing around the yoke. But other than that, it's pretty simple, just maybe a slightly more modern shape to it. I knit a gauge swatch for that last night. I need to wash that and block that today before I actually cast on. But I've got a good size gauge swatch here, and so far it looks like it's going to be alright as long as it doesn't change drastically with washing. The yarn I'm using for that is the Plymouth Superwash Merino. I believe this is a pretty new yarn. I know I purchased this at the yarn shop in Lincoln, Nebraska, and they said it was a yarn that was pretty new to them. And from looking on Ravelry, there's not very many projects in it. So I'm guessing it's a newer product for Plymouth. I don't really know that for sure, but it appears to be. And the color I have, like I say, is a dark charcoal gray. Super, super soft. Just from knitting the gauge swatch with it, it's got a nice twist. I didn't find it splitty at all, but I don't usually find yarn splitty, so I'm not sure if I'm a good indicator of that or not. But I think it has a good twist. Nice round yarn. I'm not sure how many plies this has. Five, maybe? Six plies. And this colorway that I have is ever so slightly heathered. So it's got a really nice deep dimension to it. I don't like knitting with really flat, solid colors. I like semi-solids, and this is not what I would call semi-solid, but it's got enough of a heather to it. There's just enough variegation that when you look at it, it doesn't look flat. You have it in stockinette stitch. It looks good. Something else that I would like to be casting on for in the near future is a hat. I'd mentioned before that another project I have planned for this fall is the Willoughby Wrap by Jared Flood, which is in his Made in Brooklyn booklet, which is distributed by Classic Elite. And I'm going to be making that wrap out of kind of a green-gray color. And the hat that I currently have is a bright tomato red. And I will not be wearing them together. I want to make myself another hat that I can wear with that wrap. I'm thinking of making it out of a charcoal gray, maybe a tweed or something like that. But I'm looking for a pattern that I really like that is a build cap. I have a couple of patterns that I have favorited. One of them is Sloucher by Tracy Rowling, and it has a bill, although it says that the bill is shaped with just the knitting. You don't have to insert any kind of plastic or anything in it to shape the bill. And then the body of the hat is a somewhat slouchy pattern. It's done in a bulky weight wool. The only issue I have with it that makes me a little bit hesitant is I was going through and looking at the projects in Ravelry, the people that have already knit it, and there's several people who have said that the pattern has turned out or that their knitted product has turned out much smaller than what was specified in the pattern, that perhaps the sizing might not be accurate. So that makes me a little bit hesitant to do it because I don't want to have to rework a pattern that I'm paying for. It is a pattern that's for sale. It's like $5 or $6, I think. So there's that. But I like the look of it. There's another pattern that I actually saw somebody in the Crooked Row podcast group had made. I like to scan through everybody's projects. As new people are joining the group, it's a small enough group that, you know, it's not an overwhelming number of people so far. Which, by the way, feel free to join the Crooked Row podcast group on Ravelry. But as new people join, I like to click on the profile and see, you know, where people are from, what kinds of things they're making. And it's really fun to see everybody else's projects and get some inspirations about things that I might like to make from patterns that I might not have seen before. And one of them was Tempo's head coat. And I forget who it was that had knit this, but I like the looks of it. It's another build cap. Only this one uses like a cutout from a plastic pop bottle. And then it's done in a rib. I believe it's a 2x2 rib, knit 2, purl 2 rib with the DK weight yarn. And then it looks like it's got the hem around the hat can be pulled down over the ears. That is very important to me. I need a hat that's going to cover my ears in the winter. That's kind of the whole point of it. And that's actually a free pattern. So something along that style is what I want to make to go with my Willoughby wrap that I have not yet knit, but will be making out of a gray-green yarn. And that's about all that I've been working on. It's not a lot, but I've been knitting a lot of hours. It's just been on a couple of projects. So I'll be casting on for some more things new, some more interesting things to talk about in the future. As far as the dirt that is under my nail, it has been hot, hot, hot around here. And by hot, I mean it's been in the upper 90s with the heat index in like the 110 to 115 degree Fahrenheit range. And I know that some people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world, that's not super, super hot, but for here it is. It's been extremely humid, and just recently in the past few days, it's really cooled off. Actually, Tuesday of last week was very cool. It didn't even get up to 80, I don't think, which was, I mean, it just felt cold after being used to the heat. I did have to do some watering during that hot, dry spell and run the sprinklers and soaker hoses. But the heat has been good for ripening tomatoes and melons. We harvested our first cantaloupes and watermelon in the past couple weeks, which are delicious, by the way. Super, super fresh, just being able to pick it straight from the garden and put it straight on the table. I'm very happy with the flavor of the melons. Sometimes it can seem like it's such hit and miss in the grocery store, even when they're in season. But the flavor's been really good. I'm really happy with them. I would really like to grow them again next year. Something else that we're harvesting a little bit ahead of schedule or ahead of what I had anticipated are pumpkins. We have two pumpkins and only two pumpkins, but that's okay because I've got two kids. They each have their pumpkin, so they're happy. They're turning orange, and where I have them planted is awfully close to the street. It's, you know, it's the busiest street in town, which isn't saying a lot for because I live in a very teeny tiny town. But there's enough people driving right by that I was starting to get paranoid. All it would take is one mean teenager to think it was funny to smash somebody's pumpkin, and my poor babies would be devastated that their pumpkins got smashed. So instead of leaving them out there to completely turn orange out in the garden, I went ahead and picked them and put them out on the front step So we are ready for Halloween about 2 months early. So two nice, big, beautiful pumpkins that are about basketball size. I'm very happy with them. I think next year, because I'd also like to grow pumpkins again next year. Next year, I am going to experiment with hand pollinating. And this could be for watermelons as well. I believe that both pumpkins and watermelons are plants where they have separate male and female flowers. And you'll know that it's a female flower because even before the flower has been pollinated, it has a little swollen bump behind the flower that looks like a little baby pumpkin or a little teeny tiny baby watermelon. But if that doesn't get pollinated by a male flower, then it just shrivels up and dies and doesn't develop into a fruit. But from what I have read and heard, it is really easy to just go take those male flowers, which do not have the little swollen segment behind the flower, and take the pollen on the anthers and find the pistil on the female flower, which is the little sticky part that the pollen sticks to, and just rub the pollen around on it and pollinate those so that you have more pumpkins or more watermelons. I'm going to try that next year. I think that'd be a fun thing to do, to take the kids out and teach them a little bit about the anatomy of flowers and how that works. And getting more watermelons and more pumpkins is never a bad thing. Another fun activity that we have been participating in the last few days is insect collecting. Late August around here is the peak time to be looking for insects in the garden. We have all kinds of butterflies flying around on our zinnias and all over the other butterfly attracting flowers. There's grasshoppers and crickets and spiders and all kinds of things everywhere. And this time of year too, if you leave the porch light on, there's just entire zoos full of insects that come to the back porch light at night after dark. And yesterday I was getting my son really excited about catching butterflies and pinning them. I have a few of these little shadow boxes that I got at, I believe, Hobby Lobby. I got them years ago with the intention of doing this and then never got around to it. But they're just a small wooden frame, maybe like an 8x10 or 10x12 with a glass front. And what I plan on doing is finding a thin layer of styrofoam and laying that flat across the back of the shadow box, and then covering that styrofoam with some kind of a neutral colored fabric, like a canvas or muslin or something like that, and then using that as a backdrop to put a butterfly collection or other insect collection on. I took some entomology classes in college, and it's been a while since I have done all of that stuff, but it's coming back to me, and it's a lot of fun. Last year I suggested doing it, and my son wanted nothing to do with the killing of butterflies, which is a little hard. You know, you think you catch them and kill them so that you can display them. But I figure I'm killing a lot more insects driving down the highway than I am having an insect collection, so I think I can live with it. So what we're doing, what we started doing yesterday, and I'm sure we will continue doing this afternoon, is taking a mason jar, soaking a couple of cotton balls in fingernail polish remover, putting the cotton balls into the jar, and then as you collect insects, you put them in that jar, and the fumes from the fingernail polish kills the insects, which gives you something to think about next time you're doing your nails in a not well-ventilated space. So yeah, and then once the insects are dead, you can take them out and pin them. I don't have any entomology pens right now, any specific pins. They're similar to a sewing pin that you would use, a little straight pin, but they tend to be longer and a little skinnier. I'm going to get online and see if I can find somewhere to order those. And then with the butterflies and insects that you can spread their wings, you can get what's called a spreading board, or you can make your own out of just using a piece of styrofoam. And you put a needle through the thorax of the butterfly or moth, and then you have to very, very delicately spread the wings out so that you can see them. Otherwise, they tend to just stay folded up once the insect is dead. But you spread them out using pins and little strips of paper to very, very delicately stretch out the wings until the insect is dry. Once it's dry, then you can take it off the spreading board and put it in the shadow box. So we are starting that project, and he wants to hang these shadow boxes up in his bedroom. It's his insect collection. So we've been collecting the insects. Even if you are just catching insects and then releasing them and have no intention of permanently collecting them, it's so much fun to get kids outside with a net and just poke around in your backyard, and you'd be so surprised at the variety of insects you can find in your yard. Now that insect collecting bit, I guess maybe that could double as my make yourself useful segment this week, even though it's not useful, like it's going to, I don't know, what I would usually consider useful, but it's fun. I don't have specifically a make yourself useful segment this week, but what I did want to talk about a little bit was roots. So I will be calling this segment Know Your Roots. I'm going to keep it relatively brief. I have a little bit less time this weekend to be recording. I will have a lot more time 2 weeks from now, so I'm planning on having a big old episode in 2 weeks. But I wanted to talk a little bit about plant roots. When you're growing plants in your garden, what you see is all above ground. But what's equally or even more important is what's underground, and that makes it tricky because you cannot see the roots as they are growing. So here's just a few tips about roots that you would want to keep in mind. One thing that really bugs me is the illustration on the front of the book, The Purpose-Driven Life. It's a really popular book. I'm sure many of you have read it or even have it on your bookshelf right now. It's a great book. But the illustration on the front cover drives me crazy because it's a picture of a tree. And it also shows the roots below the tree. And the illustration of the roots is basically like a mirror image of what's above ground, meaning that the roots go down extremely deep and don't spread out very far. And this drives me crazy because that's not how tree roots grow. Most of the roots of a tree, even a large tree, are in the top 18 inches of the soil. Now, they have roots that are deeper than that, and that does help anchor the tree, but most of the oxygen exchange that those roots are getting are in the top 18 inches. Below that, it becomes a lot harder for roots to get oxygen. This is why roots have a hard time growing in compacted soils, is because there's less air space, less pore space, therefore less oxygen. And those roots need the oxygen to carry out their functions of absorbing nutrients and water in the soil. So sometimes what you'll see with a tree, some trees are more prone to this than others, but let's take a maple for instance, because people tend to think of them more as a shallower rooted tree. If they're growing in compacted soil, which could be from new construction or foot traffic or anything like that, but if it's anything that's compacted, those roots will have a hard time growing deep in the soil and getting enough oxygen. So what they tend to do is grow up on top of the ground, and that's when you get the big roots kind of pop up through the grass and people mow over them, and they don't like that, and it's typically not what people like. A lot of times that's from compaction and the roots are just trying to breathe. Something else to think about is the extent of the root zone around trees and shrubs. So instead of thinking of your tree, let's envision your tree as a goblet shape, like a wine glass. with the long stem, which is the trunk, and then the larger area of the branches above. Instead of thinking of that goblet as being end-to-end with another goblet of the roots going directly beneath the tree and the same sort of shape as what's above ground, think of your tree, that same goblet, as being resting on the center of a saucer. Most of those roots of that tree are going to be the saucer. They extend out far beyond the drip line of the tree, and they're much shallower than what you might think. So whatever you're doing to the soil that is in a really large area around that tree, that's going to be affecting its roots, even farther out than you might imagine. Something else about roots that has to do with drought tolerance. There's been a real movement in more recent years for people to use drought-tolerant plants in their landscaping, which require a lot less irrigation, which is great. But what people tend to forget is that most of those plants are drought-tolerant not only because they have above-ground characteristics like thick, waxy leaves or something like that that keeps them from losing a lot of water. A lot of them are drought tolerant for their ability to grow very deep, very extensive root systems. Like in prairie plants, those grasses can go, oh goodness, I should have looked this up before I talk about it, but, you know, 6 or more feet in the ground. They're able to go deep and tap into moisture that's deep below the surface. But here's the thing. When you're first establishing those drought-resistant plants, they're not able to resist drying out until that root system is established. So the first couple years that you plant something, you still have to water it on a regular basis. When you're going to be able to take your hands off and let that thing fend for itself is going to be a few years after it's established. You have to try and think like that plant. When you first plant it, those roots are contained in that same little root ball that you planted that came out of a container, most likely. It takes a while for those to slowly seep out into the ground. Once those roots have had adequate time to spread out and do their thing, then they're going to be self-sufficient. Until then, you still have to stay on top of watering. So, with those things in mind, here are some things not to do. If you have a tree or a shrub that is already established in your lawn, don't try to build up a raised bed around that tree or shrub. There's a couple reasons. If you're building up something, whether it's centered around a tree or if it's just on top of that root zone, and remember we're talking about that goblet on the saucer, so it's a large root zone. If you are building a raised bed, what you are doing is burying those roots deeper. So it's going to be harder for those roots to get to the oxygen, and their issues with water are going to be a little bit different too. But burying it deeper is mostly going to affect the oxygen. So if you're throwing a lot of soil on top of that root zone, what you could be doing is effectively killing off that section of roots for that tree or shrub. Now, you can get away with doing a little bit of that without having a lot of issues, but if you're killing off a lot of roots or causing them to suffer over a large area, eventually you're going to see a decline of that tree or shrub. Plants have to maintain a certain root-to-shoot ratio. So what's above ground can only support a certain amount of volume of below ground roots, and the below ground roots can only support a certain volume of above ground growth. Once you start cutting off branches or cutting off roots, you're going to affect things that are on the other side of the soil line. The other issue with building raised beds around existing trees or shrubs is that you should not be piling up soil against the trunk of a tree or against the branches of a shrub and covering up the crown. And this doesn't really have as much to do with the roots. It's just that that above ground tissue is not meant to be buried in the ground. What you'll end up with is the bark rotting and getting disease in there, and you'll end up with that the trunk, the woody tissue around there dying back, and not being able to survive, or at the very most just being stunted back. This can also happen if you have too much mulch piled up around the trunk of your tree. When you are mulching around trees and shrubs, you want to only do an inch or two deep. And then when you get right up to the base of the tree or the shrub, you want to make sure that the bark doesn't have mulch piled up against it. You want to let that breathe. The other thing that you don't want to do, as I've already kind of alluded to, is you don't want to let your plants fend for themselves too early in the game. When you're establishing new plants, whether or not they're going to be drought tolerant once they're established, you have to give them that time to get established. And during that time, you have to keep them irrigated. Usually, we're talking about an inch of water a week. And what that means is if you were to have overhead irrigation from a sprinkler and you put a rain gauge out there, you water until the rain gauge has an inch full of water in it. If you're using a soaker hose, it can be a little bit trickier to determine how much you're getting on the plant. But one thing that I would recommend if you have a tree or a shrub, remember where those roots are when you first plant it. Those roots are still in that small area where you first put them for the first year or two. So make sure that that's where you're concentrating the water. And a good way to do that is just set your hose on a slow trickle, put it at the base of the plant, and then let it run for 5 or 10 minutes or so until you've saturated that root ball. That can be a much more effective way of watering your plant than just using a sprinkler. The only thing with that is you don't want to do that over and over and over again during the week. Depending on your heat, and wind and sun exposure, you shouldn't need to do that more than once or twice a week at the most. Any more than that, and what you could be doing is filling up that hole that you dug. If you don't have optimum drainage, watering from a dripping hose like that can essentially fill up that hole like a bowl. And if it's not draining really quickly, you can be oversaturating those roots, and oversaturation fills up that pore space, so you don't have what? You don't have air, and if you don't have air, you don't have oxygen, and if you don't have oxygen, the roots cannot carry out their metabolic functions. Does it sound tricky? I hope not. The key is you have to try and envision what you cannot see, and that takes some time to get used to. Sometimes it takes a few times of killing a plant and then digging it up and seeing what's actually going on under the ground. I've done that several times. So that's a little bit about roots. I haven't really talked about root pruning or roots encircling and strangling themselves or anything like that. Those things I'll hope to get to in a future podcast. But I wanted to get to a little bit of that today to have something interesting for you to think about as you are getting into this, if you are in my part of the country, hot, dry part of the year, or as you are looking towards the fall and possibly planting trees and shrubs in the fall, something to keep in mind. And now, I would like to announce the first contest winner of the Crooked Row podcast. And a couple episodes ago, I mentioned that I had accidentally gotten 2 copies of the Fall Knit Scene 2010 magazine, and I was going to give one of those away. And I had asked you to go on the Crooked Row podcast site and suggest a plant combination that you grow or would like to grow. And that would be your entry into winning this magazine. And there are some really great ideas. Everything from vegetable gardening, ornamental gardening. Some of them I'm going to read off to you here, just so in case you're not in the Crooked Row podcast group or don't check it very frequently, just to give you a little idea of what people are doing. There's suggestion of planting tomatoes and lettuce together. So the lettuce grows, you harvest it, and then as it's done growing, your tomatoes start getting large and filling in the space. I'm not going to read all of them. I'm just going to hit on some of the highlights. As far as bulbs go, staggering your blooms with the bulbs, there is a suggestion of growing crocus with tulips because the crocus come up really early, very, very early, and bloom. And then once the crocus are done, the tulips come up and take over. There is also the one about growing watergrass and dandelions. And again, I love that. Keep it up. I hope you're still listening. Another one was peas and pumpkins. So you grow the peas and the pumpkins closer together than what you would normally do by judging on the seed packet, how the spacing that they tell you to keep stuff in. Because once the peas are done, that's when your pumpkin vines are really starting to spread out. That's kind of similar to what I did in my garden with my melons and my onions. I planted them much too close together to be coexisting at the same time. But by the time the onions were ready to harvest, that's when the melons were growing over. There's talking about using pepper plants in the perennial beds. And I think that is a great idea. Peppers can be really beautiful as well as delicious. So planting them in with perennial beds is great. They also tend to be a really good size that lends them well to be planted in a sunny border. And also planting cucumbers under a winterberry shrub. So you're using the shrub as the trellis for your cucumber vine. Oh, and a couple really good ideas for shade gardening. If you have a large shade area like I do, you're always looking for some way to bring color into it because a lot of the shade plants tend to be your leafier things like hostas and things like that. And if you're not growing a lot of annuals, like impatiens, which I always grow impatiens just so I have something colorful all year, it can be tricky to get a lot of bloom throughout the year. But there were a few really great suggestions of intermixing Bleeding Heart, which is Dicentra, and Toad Lilies, which Bleeding Heart is a very early blooming plant, late spring blooming plant, which a lot of people are familiar with. And then Toad Lilies bloom very late. My Toad Lilies still have not bloomed yet. They usually won't bloom in this zone where I am, in zone 5, until September, October even. I mean, very late. Some are earlier than others, but they're definitely a late summer, early fall bloomer. So if you plant them together, you have your Bleeding Heart in the spring, and then a lot of times the Bleeding Heart will go dormant, and then the Toad Lilies grow over them and bloom in the fall. Another good combination for the shade is Epimediums and Japanese Anemones. And Epimediums also go by the name Barren Wort or Barren Root. And they are also a really early spring bloomer. And then after the flowers are done, the heart-shaped leaves grow up and make kind of a nice ground cover on wiry, like little heart-shaped flowers on wiry stems. But then if you grow those in combination with the fall blooming Japanese anemones, those grow up and bloom about now. Mine are starting to bloom right now. So it's just a way of keeping color in one area all year. Thank you for everybody who contributed your suggestions. I have some tips from there that I plan on using in the future. I hope it's been helpful to everybody else too. So what I did was I took a list of all the people who contributed to that thread and did a random number generator. And the winner is Polly81. And I have already sent you, Polly, I have already sent you a message on Ravelry about that. So you probably will have gotten that by the time you hear this podcast. So thank you for that. I hope to do more drawings and contests in the future as I have things available to give away. That's going to wrap it up for this week. A couple of announcements in parting before I let you go. I just got finished this morning recording an interview with Susan Dolph of Knit a Journey podcast. I threw myself at her and said, interview me, Susan. And she agreed because she's a very, very sweet woman. She said that that interview would be airing sometime in mid-September. So if you're not already listening to the Knit a Journey podcast, which if you aren't, why not? I'll put a link to that in the show notes and check out Susan's podcast. She does interviews with a lot of podcasters as well as doing her own podcasts. I just love listening to her. She's very calm and soothing, and she talks a lot about kind of the philosophical side of knitting. And the woman has thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail. So, I mean, she's got chops. I'll listen to anything she says. That's something that I aspire to do someday. I have a feeling I won't get it done before my body gets too old to do it, but yeah. So that's Susan Dolph of Knit a Journey podcast. The show notes for this can be found at thecrookedrow.blogspot.com. And there you will find links to the RSS feed and links to iTunes. You can also join us, as I mentioned, on the Ravelry group, the Crooked Row podcast group. You can contact me directly on Ravelry. I am on there as Crooked Row. Or you can email me at crookedrow@gmail.com. The music for this podcast is brought to you by musicalley.com. With that, I will say goodbye. Until next time, over Labor Day weekend will be the time when I record my next podcast. I should have plenty of extra time to dish out an extra large episode, so be ready for that. In the meantime, I hope you are enjoying your harvest, or if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, I hope you are having pleasant dreams of your harvest in the growing season to come. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.